Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guests are Sharon Dilworth and Jennifer Bannon from the Autumn House Press anthology, Keeping the Wolves at Bay, Stories by Emerging American Writers. Sharon Dilworth is the fiction editor at Autumn House Press. She is the author of two collections of short stories, The Long White and Women Drinking Benedictine. Her novel, Year of the Ginkgo, was published in 2010. She lives in Pittsburgh, where she is a professor of creative writing at Carnegie Mellon University. Jennifer Bannon's collection of short stories, Inventing Victor, was published by the Carnegie Mellon University Press series in short fiction in 2003. She's had stories published in ACM, Passages North, and Kenyon Review Online, and she is at work on two novels. So I think we'll start tonight talking with you, Sharon.
All right.
That's okay. And one of the things I wanted to kind of talk about to bring it in from a little bit wider angle is how you negotiate the relationship between yourself as a writer and yourself as an editor. Because I know I was reading a little bit about, you know, kind of things that you're interested in your own writing right now, being a mid-career writer, kind of looking at characters who have to kind of look back at their past and live with what has happened. And then you're putting together this anthology of emerging writers who are, regardless of age, may well be at a different point in terms of their writing career. So were there things that you had to kind of fight against, or were there things that you noticed that were qualities that you had in your writing earlier in your career that kind of sparked an interest? I'm just kind of wondering if that those two things had anything to do with one another.
No, not exactly. I mean, I read a lot. And sometimes the reading doesn't really have anything to do with my own writing. But as far as looking at stories, I mean, I get excited about stories that aren't like my own. So I didn't want to read stories about women in their middle age having crushes on their neighbors, which is what I was writing about. But I really wanted to read stories that were not like my own. So it made editing the anthology not so much an extension of my work, but something completely different.
That's great. One of the other things I guess that leads into it is to really talk about how you picked the writers. First, what was the process? Was it that you put out a call, or that the press did, or was it just you were given a pile? Kind of how did this anthology take shape?
A little bit of both. That I put out a call, the press put out a call, and I had a lot of my writing friends put out a call and asked for, and I was looking for people I didn't know as well as people I did know whose stories I really liked. So a lot of the people I don't know at all, and a lot of them are young writers. Some came out of Iowa. There are a lot of Iowa writers. But they all seemed like they had something new to say, something different to say, and also the way that they were saying it was new and fresh. So almost all different ways of getting stories and getting writers together.
And when it's right now everybody's kind of talking about wondering about what's going to happen with publishing, and, you know, especially with borders closing and some of the outlets and those kind of things. Do you think there's a different way that small presses put together anthologies than maybe some of the larger houses?
Absolutely. I know Autumn House doesn't look for the bottom line. I mean, we're not looking to make money. And I don't mean that Michael Sims doesn't want to make money, the director, but that's not, we don't have to concern ourselves so much with making, with showing a profit. And that we can sell some books, and that's fine. Where I know the larger houses need to support a huge staff, Autumn House doesn't work like that. So that we can maybe publish someone who's not going to sell that well, but that we can use them.
And one of the things I think for people who are interested in the anthology to know is that a lot of times with anthologies, they might it's more typical, I guess I should say, that the pieces in them have been appeared somewhere else, have been published somewhere else. But that's not true with this collection, is it?
No, almost all of them had not been published. And for a number of reasons. Because it was what I really wanted was the anthology to be like walking into a bookstore and seeing a book and go, oh, this is something new. This looks great. And let me read it. So I didn't want them to be collected from other anthologies. And it was also my tribute to Adios Bookstores. So that this is a place where you could find writers and find new stories as if you were going into a bookstore and browsing around.
Sure. And is that where the title came from? Where'd the title come from?
Keeping the Wolves at Bay, I learned later as an economic term, but I wanted it to be about literature, that we're going to keep these naysayers that literature is dead, that reading is dead, away. So Keeping the Wolves at Bay is a really positive, literature is fine kind of expression and prayer.
Yeah. And we're going to hear from one of the writers today, and you're actually going to read from a second writer, but I was wondering if you could give us just a little taste of like some of the things that are in the book, so people who might be interested in getting it, who some of the writers, you know, if they may know them or the work that they're doing, just, you know, a few details.
Right. We have Diane Goodman, who is a caterer down in Miami, and she writes about catering and food and that kind of life. We have Sherry Flick, who's a local writer, who wrote a very short story about a dog. I have Derek Green, who wrote a collection of short stories that took place in every country except the United States. And he wrote a funny story called Samba. Also in there is Jane Bernstein, who has a selection from a novel that she wrote, kind of a savvy New Jersey, New York story. We have Keith Banner, who I think is one of the wildest writers writing. And he writes always about transgender, gay, lesbian, people who work in places like Applebee's and laundromats.
And that's also, I know in your introduction, you write about that as well, about the kind of other things that writers have to do in order to keep themselves being writers. And it seems like this book has that kind of sensibility about it. There's a lot in there, I think, in a really good way about kind of the life you live when you're not sitting down writing about life.
Right. I'm not sure any of these stories have anything to do with writing. As I'm looking at all the titles, a lot of them seem to have to do with dogs, but I don't know what that is about.
I'm not sure. They're good dog people.
I wonder. I never noticed that before. But I think, right. I mean, I don't think these people are, a lot of them are not in academics. A lot of them are doing different things. And a lot of them are just really young, so that they haven't even really started working yet, but they are interested. And I think everyone would identify themselves first and foremost as a writer, which makes the collection exciting.
Yeah. And how did you define the term emerging? Did you have like a cutoff or not? Or
no, I just thought people who weren't household names. But as I'm looking at the list, Donald Ray Pollock just published a novel that was reviewed in the Times and got a lot of press. So maybe he's now going to be the exception. Jen Bannon, I know, is writing a novel that will probably do really well. Kevin Gonzalez, same thing. So a lot of these names are coming up.
Right. So they're
on the verge.
Right. I was just wondering if you had, sometimes with anthologies, they'll say the person can't have had a book published or, you know.
No, I didn't have any stipulations. Okay. I just was really looking for the stories, and I really looked at the stories almost more than the authors, and really looked at the story and saw, and to see if I liked it and was interested. And it was different. Than anything else I had read that day.
Okay. Well, why don't we have Jen read a little bit so we can hear one of these voices, and then we'll talk a little bit more after that. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guests tonight are Sharon Dilworth and Jennifer Bannon, who are both associated with Autumn House Press's anthology, Keeping the Wolves at Bay. So, Jen, how about you read a little bit for us?
Okay, thanks, Ellen. I wanted to give it a little bit of a setup. I'm reading from my story, Sexy Ida Makes a Vow. And the story is about a woman who's recently married and has just had a scare where she her husband didn't come home, and she thought his life was in danger, but it turns out he was fine. And so they're having dinner right after this scare the next day. He stands and motions to her from the booth and kisses her shyly on the cheek when she reaches him. They sit across from each other, and he pours plum wine into her glass. I'm a total boob. You weren't too worried, were you? Just enough. I hope you got some good shots. Evening edition. Arson for insurance money, the police think. Well, it would have been a mistake to not go. I'm proud of you, she says. A waiter arrives with hot and spicy chicken wings. He nods and smiles, setting them on the table. I hope you don't mind wings. I'm starved, her husband says. No, no, I'm famished. She reaches hungrily for a wing, as does her husband. She contemplates the morsel and its rich, clumpy sauce, looks up to her husband, and is about to tell him of her feelings regarding his imagined death, so he might laugh it off and call her a feverish planner, when, to her amazement, she sees that he has gotten a piece of chicken caught in his throat. Are you all right? He's staring wildly at her, pounding his fist into his neck, and she thinks for a moment that he looks particularly grotesque in his fear. She's frozen, listening to the strange beetle-like sounds coming from his mouth. His napkin is tucked under his chin, a dinner habit of his she's always despised but can never persuade him to abandon. It makes a large golden diamond of his torso, like a roadside danger sign. His arms begin to flail, and suddenly she knows what she is doing is right, calling out, "Help!" faintly at first, and then loudly, bravely, like a newlywed widow. There are waiters clustered around the booth, a swirling team of black and white polyester and Chinese, when the owner, he has a pencil behind his ear and street clothes on, pulls her husband from the table and throws his arms underneath her husband's in one motion. His strength is unbelievable. He's a slight man with a purposeful expression. He gives her husband quick thrusts under his breastbone, and a skinny piece of chicken is propelled from her husband's mouth and onto the wall. It sticks for a second, falls to the table, and she sees it has left a brown stain on the tastefully striped wallpaper. Such Victorian wallpaper for a Chinese restaurant, she thinks. She looks at the greasy stain instead of her husband, who she can hear coughing. He is fine. He is fine, she knows, and realizes that she is holding her chicken wing in the precise spot of air in which she'd been holding it when he began to choke. She forces herself to look at him. He's holding his neck, rubbing it, and she says, her voice far from her, dreamlike, "Are you all right?" "Yes, oh my God, yes," he says, between gagging and coughing. He thanks the owner profusely, sitting shakily back into the booth. "Let's go home," she says, and her stomach grumbles. "No, I'm fine. They're cooking our food right now. I'm fine. My throat's just a little raw." She looks around the restaurant and sees that people are turned to them from all tables. The owner is back with water. He leans over her husband, making sure he's fine. When he finally walks off, he seems to have a satisfied grin on his face. He must be thinking he's a hero, she thinks, and she understands why that might be nice. She'd love a bite of her wing, but holds it away from her mouth. "Let's have our dinner packed up to go." He relents, agreeing he is shaken up. They go home. She's driving, and suddenly he's overcome with a bout of hysterical laughter. His giggling is infectious. She, too, was unnerved, though less because of the danger and more because of the guilt she feels for having wished his death the night before. She wonders if his choking was intended for her as a lesson. When she glances at him, wiping tears from his eyes and trying to get himself together before another surge of laughter overcomes him, she starts laughing as well, so hard that she must pull over to the shoulder of the highway. The relief is exquisite. She forgets her worries. They laugh for some time, leaning across the armrest to hug each other, feeling each other's convulsive giggling, and she's relieved that he's with her, laughing with her in the car.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guests tonight are Sharon Dilworth, who is the editor, and Jennifer Bannon, who is a contributing writer to Autumn House Press's anthology, Keeping the Wolves at Bay. So, Jennifer, I guess my first question is, how is that story a good way for us to get to know your work? Like, what are some of the themes in there that maybe you're working out through some of your other pieces, or because that's one of the things that anthologies do, right? They introduce us to voices we might not know otherwise.
I like to write about the creepy thoughts that we have that we don't like to admit that we have. So I think, yeah, the sort of darker side of everyday life is very interesting to me.
Yeah, there was a real tension in that story between kind of the mundane and the underlying evil that can be underneath the mundane. I mean, the main character is kind of waiting for this evil to show up at the door, and instead it shows up at a meal.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty much her.
Yeah. And then I know I'm also kind of curious about, you know, with anthologies, and you've also done a collection of short stories, and in your bio it says you're working on a novel, how that feels to be moving to a longer form, you know, kind of how these things fit together, or are they separate, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm learning a lot as I'm working on a novel, and it's very different. But I don't seem to be able to stray from the, you know, creepy underbelly of everyday life. That's definitely still a part of what I'm doing.
Sure. And what's what are you learning in writing a novel that's different than short story?
Well, one of the main things I'm learning is you can't sort of set up your theme right at the beginning and expect to be able to keep the reader hanging on to that theme. You sort of have to meet things out a little bit more slowly. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does. I guess one of the things I'm wondering, though, too, is do you find one form more comfortable than the other? Do you just see them as kind of two different things? Like, what feels, I guess, what's prompting you to shift from story writing to novel writing?
I love reading novels. That would be my main reason. I want to write a novel because it's my favorite form for reading. Mm-hmm. But I think the novel is a more difficult form for sure. And, you know, I'm learning. It's I think short stories are really fun to write. There's just a lot more work to be done when you're writing a novel. You have to go a lot deeper.
You have to have a whole relationship. Mm-hmm. Not that you don't with a story, too, but it's, I think, when with a novel that takes a longer period of time, of course. Mm-hmm. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guests tonight are Sharon Dilworth, who's the editor of Autumn House Press anthology, Keeping the Wolves at Bay, and Jennifer Bannon is a contributing writer to the collection. One of the things that I was thinking about in terms of, you know, again, kind of going back to what's changing in the publishing industry. I mean, I think it's on everybody's minds today, and especially with this anthology, having a name that kind of points to that. Where do you think anthologies fall in the shifts that are happening? Are they still a vehicle that, you know, it seems that people are interested in buying and reading? I mean, I think that's what everybody's worried about now is what are people reading? What do you think, Sharon?
I hope people are interested in anthologies. I think they're always going to be teachable. So one thing that anthologies are great is for you can use them in university because you can teach from them. But I also think people do read anthologies. Is it going to be different if they're on the Kindle or the Nook? I'm not sure. I don't see a difference. It's a tough question. And I'm not sure. I mean, at Autumn House, I don't think the single author sells any better or any worse than an anthology. Right. In fact, we do really well with the anthologies. So that's, I'm not quite sure. I don't know how to answer that question.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, you know, all of this is still unfolding. I'm just interested in kind of continuing the conversation to kind of, I think there's an impulse that, you know, everybody likes to say the sky is falling because that creates a certain sense of drama and urgency. But I still see, you know, especially if it's strong writing, I actually see more people reading, I think, now on Kindles and those kind of things on mass trans than I have. And it seems to me that things like anthologies and short stories, in a certain way, fit our commuter society more.
Right, right. Because they are shorter, and they can you can finish a story. You could finish one story on your trip.
Yeah, and also because of, you know, our kind of, I don't know if addiction is the right word, but, you know, we're all on the internet these days. We like to click around. We like to have a variety of things. And it seems to me that anthologies gives that kind of broad palette to readers. And so I was just curious if you were...
Right. And I think novels take a time commitment that anthologies always don't. So you can pick it up, you can read it, you can put it down, come back to it. If you like it, you can read it one day, a couple weeks later, read another one.
Sure.
So that they are there.
Jennifer, kind of back to you. How did you decide to send this story in?
Well, I'd heard that Sharon was putting together an anthology, and I had just been workshopping this one with a group of writers that I meet with all for, I don't know, the last 10 years or so, once a week. And I felt pretty good about the story. It's a little bit crazy. I know Sharon. She's been my editor for a long time, and she has a taste for, you know, stuff that's somewhat off the wall. So
Sharon's smiling.
I gave
right
her a look
you're saying.
At it.
That is true. I do like the crazy. I do.
So, and, you know, I think that's also something that we don't talk about very often on the show with writers. But it's such a big part of the business as well, is really knowing what to send to who, right? It's not just finding out, do they accept, you know, whatever kind of form that you're working in, but really kind of knowing somebody's tastes or what's going to be a good fit for this. So in this anthology, Sharon, now that we know that you have a taste for the unusual, as you're looking back at it, do you see any kind of through lines between the pieces that kind of show your fingerprints on the anthology?
I do think that short stories capture a particular moment. And you were talking about the difference between novel and short story. And I think in a short story, you can really explode a moment. Where in a novel, you're more focused on the plot. And what I think I was looking for, or definitely found in this collection, is real emotion. So that you have Jen's crazy, as she says, underbelly world. You have Casey Taylor's anger. You have Kevin Gonzalez's sadness. You have Diane Goodman's nostalgia, so that they have these really strong emotions in a very particular time and place.
So you brought up Casey, and he's not here today, but I know that you were going to read a bit from one of his stories so that we can get a sense of one of the other pieces in the collection.
And I'll just do a little background on Casey. Sure. Casey is a very young writer who at one time was a postman, and I loved hearing his stories about being a postman. And now with all the changes with the post office, this may be like a historical story. but there's a lot of anger in postmen, I find. So his story is called Calvary. I ran over a cat with my mail truck today, on purpose. It made me sick when I heard the thud, as if I'd step outside of myself and watch as I did such a terrible thing. I saw the thing run out into the road, and I didn't have time to think logically. I was only thinking about payback. Revenge. Not revenge on the cat's owner, of course. I don't know whose cat that it was. It was probably a stray. The cat didn't have a collar and looked like it hadn't been groomed in some time. My guess was that it was living off of mice and bugs and running around in baseball fields at night and avoiding traffic during the day. That helped me get over the killing the cat. At least I knew that no kids were going to cry because of what I did. Nobody's parents were going to try and find a way to explain that things live and things die, and that's why Boots was nothing more than a smear on the road. I jogged out of my truck and scraped the cat off the road with an empty mail tray. It peeled off the road with a sick sound, like pulling a Band-Aid off of a week-old scab. The hairs pulled out gradually, and the traces of pus clung to the wound. I gagged a bit, and threw it in my truck next to the packages I still had left for Sycamore Street. The truck was hot. I hated delivering mail in the summer months. They didn't give us air conditioning in the trucks. Instead, they had these small personal fans that didn't do anything except blow hot air around the truck. It didn't do much, but it made me sweat more than usual. I made deliveries for another half hour or so, and then my phone rang. It was Jim. Sully's looking for you. What do you say? I asked. Probably a neighbor calling to complain about the dead cat. People were always calling the post office to complain about the dumbest stuff. He didn't say anything, just asked if I knew where you were delivering, and I told him I wasn't sure. Whatever. What'd you do? I didn't do anything yet. Don't worry about it. You should change routes, he said. I don't think this is good for you, man. I don't think you should deliver to that dude anymore. I'm fine, I said. Jim was always worrying about something. You're going to get yourself fired if you keep messing with that dude. Some things are more important than a job, I said, and I meant it. I didn't need that job at the post office. My integrity was on the line.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Waite, and my guests are Sharon Dilworth, who is editor of the Autumn House Press anthology, Keeping the Wolves at Bay, and Jennifer Bannon, who is one of the contributing writers. That was an intense story.
And a little crazy.
I think we're starting to see something about you, Sharon.
Yeah, oh, no.
In terms of your selections. Not a bad thing.
No, no, I hope not.
You're not someone who wants to have a story that lets them sit back passively.
No, not in this collection, at least.
One of the things, and this could be for either one of you to answer, is just if it's a little off track, but it's talking about point of view, in that if you have a preference these days, in terms of, I know there was kind of a big wave of a lot of first-person points of view that were coming out, a lot of I stories, and then it seems there's been a bit of a pushback on that, and people are trying kind of other techniques. And if that's something that you're, one, how you pick it when you're writing a story, Jennifer, and then also, Sharon, if that's something that, you know, if there's a certain criteria you have, whether it's a first-person or a third-person, like a first-person has to do a certain thing.
I'll answer that from the writer's perspective. I worked on a novel for several years from the third person point of view that looked at three different people. And it was really extremely difficult. It was also a lot of fun. But now I'm actually returning to the first person point of view in a new novel that I'm working on, sort of letting that other one do its thing on
rest.
Its own for a little while. Yeah, percolate, whatever. So maybe I'm going against the grain because now I'm all immersed in the first person and really happy to be back there again.
What is it about the first person that makes you happier?
It's just, I have some acting background, okay. And it's just easier to jump in and pretend like it's you.
I think
that's the reason. It's easier to locate voice and to just, you know, it's almost like you're pretending.
Sure.
This is me.
Assuming the personality.
Exactly.
Sharon, in terms of, you know, because I've talked to different editors and you know, Jennifer brought up the concept of voice, you know, that's one of the things they're really looking for. So do you feel, you've already talked about the intensity of the emotion in the stories. Do you have a preference? You know, I know you probably say either one works well, but are there things that you think work better or worse in points of view?
I think it really depends on the story. For example, in Casey's story, it's so in the moment and there's so much anger and so much rage that this guy feels. It's almost like a confession. So right. First person seems absolutely necessary. But there are other stories where you're maybe a step back or there's some time that's passed. But this story, this guy is in this moment. He's mad. He's full of rage. And he's just going to attack. And he attacks everything. He hates the truck. He hates the cats. He hates the friends. He hates the job. It's all first person. And almost like a angry confession.
Sure.
So that seems to fit the story. Writers, I think, when they first start writing, write first person, which seems natural because we're taking on a different persona, so it seems that would be the natural first step. But I think when the story's good, you don't quite realize, oh my gosh, this is in first person. At least I don't as an editor. I just go, oh, this works. Yeah. But I have read stories where the point of view doesn't work. So it's first person and it's too distant. And you go, oh, this doesn't quite work.
So when a situation like that would happen, I guess I'm also wondering, like, what interaction you had with the writers? Was it you just accepted the story's whole cloth, yes or no? Or did you work with them? Or how did that work?
No, I accepted the stories almost full on. So the only thing I did was sometimes I said, I really, really like your writing, but I can't use this story for a particular reason. Do you have another story for me?
Okay.
And that happened for different reasons.
Sure. And then the other thing I was wondering is the order of the stories when you're putting an anthology together. Are they alphabetical? I didn't really look. Like, how is it put together, the juxtapositions?
These are alphabetical.
That really worked out well for me because my last name's Bannon. So I was first.
And I wanted Jen to be first, so...
Thanks,
it was no, that. These were alphabetical for the very reason just it was just a way to just... It didn't matter how the stories came out to me. I wanted just the collection.
Sure. Well, I want to thank both of you ladies for coming and talking on Prosody.
Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you for having us.
You've been listening to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday at 6:30 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 90.5 FM.